theoretical physics, so it divides time between the two places. And Cliff actually has his PhD in theoretical physics from the University of Texas under Steven Weinberg, who won a Nobel Prize in physics for work in high-energy physics and quantum neutron standard model some years ago. He works in the areas of cosmology, string theory, and particle physics. And I hope I'm not haven't left anything out there. He's actually one of our also one of our more experienced researchers in outreach, and gives a lot of these talks, and every single one of these talks I've been to by Cliff, the audience has been thoroughly excited and gotten a lot out of it, and really, really found them useful. Amongst other things, he's actually the only person I've ever seen explain to an audience of the general public why it's probably true that aliens have sex. in a scientific context. And also explaining string theory in terms of the movie Casablanca. Maybe you can ask him about those later on. Without any further ado, what is the universe made of? The case for dark matter and dark energy, Professor Fisher.
This isn't the sex talk, I'm afraid. So thanks for coming. I'm glad to have you here. You know, people probably don't tell you this enough, but teachers and the influence they have on kids, you know, I've got kids that have just come through the high school system. I can remember my physics teachers when I was in high school. It made a huge difference. You know, I'm sure you don't hear that as often as you need to hear it, but it's true. So I'd like to talk about cosmology and kind of where what's happening in cosmology now, and in particular, what's the universe made of, because we're at a crossroads in cosmology, and it's a paradox, really, because it's the paradox is that this is, the Big Bang model of cosmology was invented in the 50s, I think, or the 60s, and since the 60s, it's been pretty clear that it's probably close to what's going on, but in the last 10 years, there's been an enormous number of tests of the Big Bang models, and it's put it on a footing which is really unprecedentedly well established. So on the one hand, it's a triumph that people think they really understand what the universe is like. But on the other hand, there's a paradox in the triumph because it all works, but because it works, you actually can do a budget of what everything in the universe is, what the energy in the universe is, what fraction of it is made of atoms and of other things. And the surprise is that every kind of matter that we know about, so atoms, you know, not just atoms, but anything made of protons or neutrons or any particles that we've ever seen experimentally, is at most something like 4% of what's out there. And not only that, the remaining 96% is two different kinds of things, and there's 75% of dark energy and 20% of dark matter. And so the paradox is, you know, how can you have a triumph when you really, it rests on the assumption that you've got these two other things there that you have no idea what they are. So that sounds like it wasn't such a big triumph. It's like epicycles or something in for Newton. So the point of the talk is going to be why those things aren't in contradiction with one another. So what is the evidence for there being all this dark energy and dark matter, and how does that evidence come together with all the evidence in favor of the Big Bang cosmology, and what I hope you'll see is that there's a real parallel with the convincing people of why atoms exist. You know, and if you go back to Einstein's time, there was a community that thought atoms existed, but it wasn't really Boltzmann committed suicide because nobody believed him that atoms existed, and it was what really convinced people in the end of the day that atoms were there. Wasn't that they saw them. I mean, you can see them now, but it wasn't until when I was a kid, people said you never see atoms, they're too small. But the what really convinced people was that there was a whole bunch of different lines of evidence where you could infer the number of atoms in a gram of material, say, with a whole bunch of different ways. And they all gave you the same answer. And the fact that you had 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 different kind of lines, independent lines of thought, which all gave you the same answer, is what really convinced people that atoms are there. And then we will see them eventually, but you didn't have to wait to see them before you really knew they were there. And so I tell you that because the criterion for a good argument for the existence of things you haven't seen is that there can't be just one piece of evidence. There's got to be several lines of evidence. And so the whole thrust of this talk will be to highlight that there's a lot of different lines of evidence. And I won't be able to tell them all to you, but pointing to the existence of two different kinds of things that are not there. And the fact that they haven't been discovered yet I hope you'll agree at the end, isn't really a compelling. You worry until you discover them. People have to discover them, just like you discovered others. But the fact that there's more than one line of evidence is what makes it not a crazy story. So the way I'll go through it all is I'll remind you what the Big Bang is. And it starts off with the evidence that the universe is expanding. And then the Big Bang is the theory as to why it's expanding. And then part of the evidence, once I told you what the evidence for the Big Bang is, then that will lead you to what the evidence is for the dark matter and dark energy, because it's all embedded into the evidence for the Big Bang. And then if there's time at the end, and there may not be, I'll tell you, so people, you know, this is field day for people that are in the business of trying to figure out what the universe, how it works, because 96% of it is up for grabs, something like that. So there's been a lot of thinking about what this could be, and so I'll tell you some of the thinking. Dark matter, turns out the short version, in case I don't get to it, is that, you know, every second graduate student in particle physics has a theory of dark matter, because it's actually not so hard to get a theory of dark matter. So that means that probably we have a pretty good idea of what it's going to be, although no one's really sure. But the dark energy is a lot harder, and that it hasn't yet passed what they call the ego test. That if you come to somebody and you say, you find someone who's enthusiastic about a theory of dark energy, then you ask them, did you write that paper? They'll always say yes. And so that no one's been able to convince anyone else that they've got a good theory of dark energy. So there's no consensus building around any particular ideas there. And then I'll kind of finish off. And I guess you guys have had lunch, but I'll have lunch. So I used to give this last year during the Einstein Standard, so this is sprinkled with Einstein quotes. And they all fit at some level. So why bring Einstein into it at all? It's because of the basic thing about cosmology. The reason it was been possible to do cosmology in the 20th century, and where Newton didn't really have a lot to say about cosmology, is that what Einstein did with gravity, it's all about gravity, right? That's why things in space are doing what they're doing, for the most part. And the difference between Einstein and Newton's picture of gravity is that for Einstein, gravity is geometry. So in Einstein's picture, it's why the sun deflects light or whatever, the trajectory of a particle going by the sun. The logic is not that there's a force between the sun and the object. The logic is that if you have a big source of energy like the sun, it curves space around itself. And then anything that goes by now is moving through curved space. And how it moves, you can describe just by the fact that it's in curved space. And it wants to go in as straight a line as it possibly can. But if the space itself is curved, it can't go in a straight line, and so it bends. And that's what we interpret as being the deflection of its motion due to the gravitational force. But this connection between gravity and geometry has a spin-off for cosmology, because Einstein was thinking about how do objects attract one another, but if you now think of the universe as a whole, if you know where all the energy is, then you know the geometry of the universe as a whole, and so you can say, what's its shape? You know, is it a sphere, or is it a plane, or is it a torus? And you can also ask, how things, it's not the geometry in space, it's geometry in space and time, and so you won't, not only do you learn what the geometry is now, say it's a sphere, you know where it's going, so how is it evolving, and so is the universe expanding or contracting or doing something interesting. And so this connection between gravity and geometry underlies all of cosmology, because what people actually do is they go out and they look, where is the energy, and they count where the stars are, or they do something else. And then they're inferring the properties of the space and what it's going to do because of this connection between gravity and geometry. So knowing how matter is distributed is the thing that will tell you what the shape of the universe is and what it's doing and where it's been. And so now the triumph of the last 15 years has been that there's much more known now about where matter is in the universe. That's kind of really what drives, that's been driving the advance in cosmology. So this is a map of the sky. So most of the matter, if you just look in the sky, you look around yourself, you see stars. All the stars you see essentially in the sky are in our galaxy, which is not this one, but it's like this one. This is the Andromeda galaxy, which is the most distant thing you can see with your naked eye. It's visible. You can see it in the city if you know where to look. It's about the size of the moon, if you look at it. And the reason it's hard to see normally is that it's just dim. So if you have to be in a dark place, normally not in the city, and it's a fuzzy spot. If you know where to look, it's just a fuzzy spot in the sky. It's 3 million light years away. The light takes that long to get here. And our galaxy is like that. And we're falling towards each other. And every star that you see in the sky is in our galaxy. But if you kind of look beyond our galaxy to where the stars are, they're all in other galaxies for the most part. There's the odd outlier that's just roaming around, not in a galaxy. And if you map where they are, this is what you get. This is supposed to be a picture of it's like a globe. It's like the inside of the sky, but unrolled into a map, much like a globe would have been. So this is the whole sky in all different directions. And each blue dot here is a galaxy, and the big brown smear is our galaxy. So as we're looking, it's a disc-shaped thing. And as you look out, there's kind of a circle in the sky where you're seeing things in the foreground, not what's outside of it. So ignore the big brown thing. But all these blue things are the other galaxies. And you see that they tend to clump around each other. And it's because gravity makes them all attract each other. But basically, they're uniformly distributed across the sky. So Einstein was one of the first people to think about cosmology. And he just made a guess. So what's the simplest thing you could assume? We don't know where the hell stuff is. Let's just assume it's uniformly distributed around the sky. That used to be called the cosmological principle. Now it's just an observational thing, and people can see where the all is. And you might worry that that's a two-dimensional picture. You see where they are in direction, but you don't see how far away they are. They could all be the same distance, and that wouldn't be uniform. But nowadays, you can do better. This is, again, not an artist's conception. This is a map, a three-dimensional map of where galaxies are in the sky. We're in the middle. It's in slices because they're not finished the map yet. So they're kind of surveying where the galaxies are, and they measure the distance, too, as well as where they look. And as we zoom in, you'll see that there are all these specks here are galaxies. They're not the photographs of the relevant galaxies, but they're all in the place where a galaxy would be. So every one of these things is a galaxy. And as we head in there, then you get closer and closer and closer to where we are. It looks like the galaxies start to peter out here, but that's because the way they're looking, they can most efficiently find things that are farther away than close up. And so it's not really true that there's fewer galaxies near us. But now they're going to zoom out again. And outside all the galaxies, you'll see there's a bunch of red things that are going to go in there, which are a special kind of galaxy, which is very, very distant from us, which you can see better in red because of a reason I'll tell you about the second universe is expanding. So as you go out, you zoom out, you can see that essentially in these slices they've looked at, there's nothing special. The things are uniform in the third dimension as well as the first two dimensions. Now these are these extra galaxies and quasars that are farther away than most galaxies. They're very bright, so you can see them a long ways away. And this last thing you'll see is that you're about to see a blue thing in our face here. And that's what's called the microwave background radiation, which is the light that's coming from as far as anything in the universe we can see. And I'll talk about that a lot in the talk, and I'll say what it is then. But beyond that, the universe is actually not transparent anymore, so you can't see any farther than this light. And so it kind of puts in perspective how far away all these things are. And the light that this last green blue thing is something like 15 billion light years away. So the main message there is that we know actually a lot about where the galaxies are now, and that's mostly coming through automation. But it takes a long time to find where these things are, so they just dedicate a telescope to it, and they just automate the process, where they just look for millions and millions of galaxies. The hard part is to find them, of course, because they look like stars. So it's uniformly distributed. So now what does that mean for what the geometry of the universe is, and in particular, how is the universe changing? So the once you know where they are, the next thing you want to know is where they're going. And so the same measurements that tell you where they are, or even measurements before that, tell you what they're doing. And the short version is that they're all moving away from us, and that's the first piece of evidence that the universe is expanding. So I'm going to there's a whole bunch of lines of evidence for the expansion of the universe, and I'm only going to talk really about the second one there. If you look at all those galaxies, all but 10 of them, and so there's hundreds of billions of galaxies have been found now, and all but 10 of them are moving away from us. And all but the very nearest ones are moving in a very, very specific way, that the speed of recession from us, v, is proportional to the distance from us, with some universal constant in front called the Hubble constant. And that constant is something like 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So every extra, a megaparsec is something like 100 million, 300 million light years. So every 300 million light years you move away from us, you get another 70 kilometers per second in speed for these galaxies. And that rule is a very special rule, because one thing, if you kind of ask where they all started off from, that's the rule where they all started off here at the same time, because the ones that are twice as far away are moving twice as fast. And so if you follow them back, they're all here at the same time. And that's the explanation, or that could be an explanation as to why that rule is true. The ones that are farther away are there because they're moving faster, and they all started here together. So that's the first piece of evidence that there was a Big Bang, that there's a special time when everybody is at the same spot. Assuming that the speed never changes, which is not quite a right assumption, as I'll come back to. All right, so this is just this is an observational thing. It's not just it's a precise thing. This is a plot of speed against distance, and then the fact that these things lie in a straight line is the expression that this is a linear relationship. And so it really seems to be true. And I'm going to come back to this plot later on, because this goes out to about 500 megaparsecs. So that's something like 1,500 light years. 1,500 million light years. So it's 1.5 billion light years away. And the galaxies I showed you go out farther. So that one of the interesting things that's happened is people have measured this farther than before. And it's no longer straight. It's what I'm going to come back to. How do you know they're moving? You use the Doppler effect, which is that light from a moving source, if it's moving away from you, looks more red than it was originally. If it's moving towards you, it looks more blue. And it's the, as you I'm sure all know, it's like the visual visual train. The train crosses a junction, it goes na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na is the approaching, and na-na-na-na-na is the proceeding. And colors like that for pitch, you see is color for light, and you hear it as pitch. And how do you know what the color was? It's because the light comes to you from atoms, and the atoms emit light in very specific colors. And so you kind of end up identifying the pattern of light that corresponds to, say, hydrogen. You can see that it's shifted compared to the hydrogen you see on the Earth. So you really have a handle on what's happening. Now, one thing you could ask is that there's a contradiction there, because if they all started here together, that sounds like an explosion. But if someone set a bomb off in this room, you could ask, where it was. It's wherever the hole is a special place in the universe, because that's where the bomb went off. And I've been telling you that the stuff is distributed around the universe completely uniformly and isotropically, and there's no place that you can identify which looks like a special place where the bomb went off. And so that's could be, you might think of that as being a puzzle, but it's really not if you think about of this in the context of geometry. But I told you that the galaxies are moving because of the Doppler effect, and that's not really a lie, but there's another way of thinking about it which is actually a better picture of what's going on. And that is that it's not so much that the galaxies are moving apart from us in space, it's that space is expanding and it's carrying the galaxies away from us, but they're not really moving relative to the space around themselves. And so the picture is, this is a better picture of what's going on. All of the yellow dots are galaxies, and so because space is expanding, they all get farther apart from one another. And all the little wiggly lines are light rays. And so they start off as being blue, but as the space gets bigger, the wavelength gets bigger too, because all lengths are getting bigger. And so they become more red than they were, because that's a longer wavelength. And so a better way to think about this change of color of these receding galaxies is not so much that it's a Doppler effect, but that it's really just the fact that the universe is, in the time that it's taken the light to get here from there, the universe got bigger, and so all the wavelengths got bigger too, and so all the lights got redder. And so in this picture, you're not led to be thinking of a special place in space where the bomb went off, because the whole, all of space actually came down to the same size. And so the damage was everywhere at some level. And so that's what Einstein's gravity says should happen, but it's also consistent with what we see. The fact that there's no hole anywhere is evidence that it's really space that's expanding rather than galaxies moving apart from one another in a fixed space. So the Big Bang takes that and runs with it. So the observational evidence is that the universe is expanding. But then the question is, why is it expanding? And so the thinking of the Big Bang is that if you extrapolate things backwards, an expanding container tends to cool, and so if you contracted a container, it would get hotter. And so it's probably true that in the past, all the galaxies would have collided. If we ran the universe backwards, the galaxies would all collide together, and there'd be some hot mess. And so the hot Big Bang theory says, well, let's suppose that the universe starts off as a very small hot mess, very uniform soup of whatever the elementary particles are at the time, and then just let it expand. Could you know now, are there any relics now that would tell you that that's how the universe came to be? And the main message of the next half of the talk is that there are relics, and those relics have been found. And so we have direct observational evidence that the universe really was once 10 billion degrees hot, and it was a soup made of just protons and neutrons. Earlier than that, we don't have no direct evidence, but there really is evidence that this hot picture is working. And when I say this, for the evidence for the hot Big Bang, the evidence is not just that the universe is expanding, it's that this specific mechanism for why it's expanding is true, that once it was very, very hot, and a very hot gas will likely expand. So why does expansion have anything to do with heat? This is an app that you can get off the web. I can't resist running. So it's kind of, the universe is like a big dust box wherever it was, because you can never get out. And so, which if your heat can't get out. And so what this is supposed to show you is that, so here you go, this is kind of a box, and if you wanted to fill it with atoms, then here's a bunch of atoms. Yeah. And here's more. And so you can kind of follow how much pressure there is and what the temperature is. And it's a function of the motion of the atoms. The main message here is, you know, heat is the average motion, the random motion of the molecules in the box. And you can see that because if I turn the fire on here and make it hotter, then they'll all speed up. You see the temperature goes up, but then also you can see everybody's moving faster.
That's slow.
As I turn it on. And then if you cool it down, then they'll all slow down. And as the temperature comes down, their average speed falls. And so the main, for cosmology thing that's relevant for is that if I change the size of the box, everybody speeds up and it's higher. But if I make the box smaller, then everybody slows down and it cools down. So that's the physics that you need for cosmology. It's just that as the universe gets bigger, everything cools down just because of the same reason that when a box gets bigger, it cools down. It's a little bit more complicated because there's no walls. You know, you can also ask here what happens if there's no walls and you just take the lid off here and then in the box they escape, but that doesn't happen. That cools things off too. That's why the atmosphere is cool, because they can lose things off the telephone. But it's really, for this talk, what's important is that expanding things cool. And so that's all you need to know for the Big Bang. Start off hot, it cools. Now, the important thing about cooling is that it tells you what the stuff is made out of. If heat is the random energy of things moving around, and hotter means things are moving faster, then as they collide more violently, it gets hotter. And so if you imagine taking everything in this room and heating it to 10 million degrees, then what would happen, you know, besides us burning, would be that the atoms wouldn't actually survive anymore, because the atoms are made of nuclei and electrons, and they would collide so energetically that they just knock all the electrons off, and you just end up with electrons and the nuclei running around for free. And so the hotter it is, the more violently you're colliding, and so the more the things that you're making your gas up out of get broken apart. So if you get above, actually, you only have to get about 1,000 degrees before atoms fall apart. But if you get up to 10 million degrees, the nuclei fall apart. But the protons and neutrons in the nuclei get knocked apart. And it doesn't mean that they're not forming all the time. If it was 10 billion degrees, then protons and neutrons would form nuclei all the time. But as often as they form them, they get knocked apart. So on average, you don't have any nuclei. But as the universe cools, what happens is that you cool down to the point where you no longer have enough energy to knock nuclei apart. And what happens is that as the protons and neutrons find each other and make nuclei, they no longer get knocked apart as the universe cools. And so there's a point after which nuclei can survive. And there's a later point after which it's cool enough that atoms can survive. And when you're looking for relics, what you're essentially looking for is the relics of that process of nuclei forming and atoms forming. And so the main message is, as things cool, eventually the collisions are not violent enough to destroy things. And the more tightly bound you are, the earlier you can survive and not be destroyed as things cool. So nuclei form at 10 billion degrees. Atoms form at 1,000 degrees, and there is observable relics for both those processes of formation that I'm going to tell you about in great detail. So what's the evidence for that process happening? Well, I'm going to start off with the evidence for the nuclei forming, because that's the earliest direct evidence we have that this picture is right. So there's three kinds of evidence. These three pieces of evidence are, the first one is the evidence for nuclei forming, the second one is the evidence for atoms forming, and the last one I won't talk about, but it's a separate piece of evidence. If you all these things I'm not talking about in this left-hand list, I have slides for if you want to ask about it later on, but it's, otherwise it gets too long. So what's the evidence that nuclei once formed? Well, the evidence is this. So if you know that nuclei are forming, then in particular you can predict how much of each nucleus you get. And the light nuclei, you know, heavier than hydrogen, you get helium, lithium, and beryllium. It turns out you don't get anything heavier than that, because it's hard to make. There's not enough nuclei around to make things like carbon. That has to all be made in stars, and so we're all made of stars stuff, because we're made of carbon and nitrogen and oxygen. None of that gets made in the early universe, because it can't be made. But you can predict how much helium you should get, and you can predict how much lithium you can get. And not only that, helium comes in many types. There's helium, you know, if I go back to this slide, nuclei are made of protons and neutrons. So the blue ones are protons, and the red ones are neutrons. And the chemistry is determined by the protons, because that sets the charge. The protons carry charge, and that sets the charge of the nucleus. And the electrons, the number of electrons you attract to the nucleus is set by the charge. That's the chemistry. But depending on how many neutrons you have, you get different mass of the atoms. And so you can predict how much helium-4 you can get, or helium-3 you can get, and all different kinds of helium and lithium. And the thing is that that prediction essentially agrees with what's seen. You can measure the abundances of those things, and it works. And the fact that it works tells you something very interesting. So I'm going to beat on this a little bit. So switch there. So the reason I'm going to beat on it is that the fact that it works, it works, but only if the total number of protons and neutrons in the universe is a specific number. So this is going to be a way of counting the total number of atoms in the universe. So when I tell you that there's 96% of the stuff hasn't been seen, I'm going to not only tell you it hasn't been seen, but it's not atoms. And so I have to have an argument as to why you know it's not atoms. And so the second thing is that the fact that it works tells you also how fast the universe is expanding at the time, because that's how fast it's cooling. And both those things will be important later on. So this is a picture of what happens basically is that a proton and neutrons running around, they're colliding randomly, and when they find each other, they have some probability of forming a nucleus. And so protons and neutrons will form heavy hydrogen, which is deuterium. It has one proton and one neutron. And then another neutron can hit it and make tritium, which is one proton and two neutrons. Or it could be that two deuteriums hit each other and they make helium-4. And what this is showing you is the result of a computer program where this is time on the cross at the bottom in seconds. This is 10 seconds, 100 seconds. We're talking the first few minutes in the universe here. And this is a relative abundance of these various things, where zero is everything, and this is a tenth of what's there, and this is a hundredth of what's there, and this is 10 to the minus 5 of what's there. And the line across the top is the number of protons that are around, which is essentially hydrogen. It says mostly everything in the universe is hydrogen, which is still true. 90% of what's out there by mass is hydrogen. This is neutrons. There's less than there were protons for a reason, which is it's because they're a little bit heavier. And so there's an understanding of that. The lines are not parallel. That's because the neutrons actually decay into protons, it turns out, as time goes on. And they have a decay lifetime of about 10 to 12 minutes. And so in this kind of time frame, you can see them decaying. But what happens is that every once in a while, a proton and a neutron makes heavy hydrogen. And that's the red line. This is the abundance of heavy hydrogen. The longer you wait, the more you get. And so you get more and more and more and more of this heavy hydrogen. But then it starts to go down because it starts to get cooked into other things. And so it gets cooked into helium. The green line is helium-4. It's a very stable nucleus. Once you've got it, it stays there. And these other things are what other elements are doing. Helium-3 is two protons and a neutron. It gets formed eventually. This is tritium, which is one proton and two neutrons. This is beryllium-7, neodymium-7. You can read all the labels. The main message is, there's a bunch of activity right around then. And right around then is special. What's special about that time is that's when the temperature gets cold enough that you no longer knock these things apart. Down here, you're making deuterium, but you're knocking it apart just as fast. And then you get more and more and more because as the universe cools, you knock it apart less frequently. And so it starts to accumulate. And once you're past this time, everything settles down. And so the late abundances you get to measure are more or less set. And what we're going to be interested in is what's the relative amount of helium 4 to helium 3 to tritium to whatever. And so that's the next thing is now showing you that. So now this is now plotting the final, what you got at the end, against something across the bottom, which I'll describe. So this is now the abundance of helium 4 that you would get as a function of the total number of atoms in the universe. Why does it depend on that? It doesn't depend very strongly on that. It depends on the number of atoms because the process was the neutrons and protons had to find each other, but if there's fewer of them, they have a harder time finding each other. That's all it is. So that the less stuff there is, the less likely it is that there will be a reaction that produces a nucleus, and the less nuclei you'll get. And so this is a measure of how many atoms there are in the funny units, where 1 is 10 to the minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter. And that's not a random number. That's going to turn out to be the density of energy in the universe now. So this is how much there is. And the more there is, the more you are to the right. And that's the line is climbing because you get more nuclei, the more stuff there is. And then the horizontal faint line is the measured abundance of helium-4. So the fact that this agrees and there's a wide range says that not only do we know that we can account for the helium-4 that's out there, but it's telling us roughly how much stuff there is out there, how many atoms are out there, because it's only agreeing for a particular abundance of atoms. If you have fewer atoms than the mid-range here, you're not going to get enough helium-4 to agree with what's out there. So if we do the same thing for helium-3, this is what you get. The theoretical curve is this. This is what you predict. It goes down because they get knocked apart to make helium-4. This is what you measure, and they agree for that specific kind of number of atoms. So this is a much better measure as to how many atoms are out there because it's more sensitive to how many atoms are out there than the helium-4 was. This is what it is for deuterium, one proton, one neutron. That's the theoretical prediction. That's the measurement. This is what it is for beryllium or lithium-7. Seven is the theoretical curve. That's the measurement. And now the thing that's special there is that they all agree for one value of the total number of atoms out there. And that tells you something. That tells you that I'm not nuts. Right? The first thing you learn from that is that this is probably why those things are up there. You could have said at the very beginning, well, maybe we're just wrong. Maybe the lithium you measure up there or the beryllium you measure up there is made some other way. The fact that these things all agree is telling you that this is probably the right reason for explaining why this stuff is there. So that the physics that makes these nuclei is probably the physics of the universe expanding. That's the first thing you get. And the second thing you get is you know how many atoms are out there. You know there's this much. This is a log scale. This is a tenth of all the stuff out there. This is a 1%. This says about 4% of what's out there has to be atoms. If you want to believe that this is a total number of, this is the description of the abundance of the nuclei that you find in the universe. So that's the first piece of evidence that what you're seeing, given what I haven't told you yet, is that this is really the total amount of stuff that's out there. The fact that this is not one is telling you that the atoms aren't everything. That's the first line of evidence. So that's the nuclear story. The fact that you can get the abundances of nuclei right says that you probably understand the universe was hot when at the 10 billion degrees and nuclei could form at some point, and the details work. And it's consistent with didn't have to work, but everything, several different measurements of the total number of atoms all gave you the same number, which is a consistency check. So what about atoms? When atoms form, electrons are binding to nuclei now, much cooler temperatures. Is there a similar way of seeing that happen? And there is. But it's a different, you don't count the number of atoms, the number of ions that are out there. It's the difference here is that the way you know that atoms formed is you have to think about how the universe would have looked before atoms formed. When the universe was above 1,000 degrees, it was a bunch of nuclei and electrons running around because, again, every time an atom formed, it got left apart. Now, if you're a light wave, you're moving around, you're a photon trying to move through the universe then, what happens is that electrons and nuclei are electrically charged, so they're really efficient at scattering light. And so light wouldn't move in straight lines if you were in the universe then. It's like actually the middle of the sun is like this too. This is kind of, the temperatures in the center of the sun are higher than this. And if you were in the middle of the sun, again, you'd burn up, but if you didn't, you put your hand in front of you, then you couldn't see anything because it'd be like living in a fog because the light from your hand would bounce around so often that it wouldn't come to your eye. So if the light arrived in this direction, it didn't come from that direction. And we're all used to thinking that if you see, that's where light came from. And in an environment like this, it wouldn't be like that. It'd be like living in a fog where it's a luminous fog, there's a lot of light there, but it's not transparent because it's electrically charged. Light takes hundreds of thousands of years to get out of the sun. The sun is about one light second across. If neutrinos take a second to get out of the sun, because they go straight out. But light bounces around so much because of this that it takes 100,000 years to get out. And the sun could have died on the inside and it would take 100,000 years to know it because the heat and the light wouldn't get out that fast. Just because it bounces around so much down its way out. So that's what it would be like before the atoms form. But once the atoms form, the electrons all find a nucleus, and then what's left is neutral. And it doesn't scatter light anymore, and that's why the air in the room is transparent. So the main thing about the formation of atoms is that the universe becomes transparent. So you're in an opaque cloud, which is luminous, and all of a sudden, you know, bing, it's transparent. But all the light that was there is still there. It's just not hitting anything. It's just running around the universe, and it just keeps on as the universe expanding and running around. And you can still see it. So what people have done is they found it. That light that was there, the last time it scattered from something was when the universe was just forming atoms. And since then, it hasn't hit anything. And it's until it hits your, it actually even you can see it in your TV set. When you turn your TV set on and you're not on a channel and you just get noise, something like 5% of that or 10% of that noise is microwaves from the universe. And that's just light that hasn't hit anything until it hits your antenna. So the fact that you can see that light, and it's consistent with that the last time it saw something it was interacting with a hot gas, is it also a confirmation that the universe cooled off the atoms formed at one point. I told you that already. These are the guys that found it. They found it in a microwave horn that Bell Labs was building in New Jersey in the 60s. They weren't looking for it. They were trying to make a good microwave horn. And the way that you tell if it's working is you point it at something which is not giving you microwaves, and you check that you see nothing. So they pointed it up, and they never got nothing. And so they thought that there was a problem with the horn. What they really were finding was that they were seeing the fact that the universe is sending its microwaves because that's the light that from the Big Bang. And they did the famous story that they have in their paper is that they talk about they think of all possible ways that they could be screwing up the horn, including they sent a graduate student up to clean all the pigeon shit out of the horn because that affects how it receives microwaves. So at the end of the day, it was for science. You know. That's what you tell a graduate student, it's for science. Yeah. So this is what it looks like. So if you look at its temperature, it was 1,000 degrees when it last hit when the universe became transparent. But we've expanded a lot since then, and so it all got cooler. And so now it's at 3 degrees, so it's very cold, and that's why it's microwaves rather than visible light. And if you look at the temperatures of pumpkin at a distance, a direction, I'm sorry, this is a map of the sky in microwaves, and this is a, so this is a 360 degrees across the sky, and these are the hot areas, these are the cold areas. And what I haven't told you is the scale. So that there's 3 degrees, you could say, well, which of those is 3 degrees? Is it the pink areas or the blue areas? The difference between a pink area and a blue area is 1/100,000th of a degree. So it's 3 degrees plus or minus 1 part of a pop. So it's a fantastically accurately the same temperature in all directions, but not exactly the same temperature in all directions. And I'm lying to you a little bit because they process the data for this. If you actually did the raw data, it's half the sky is blue and the other half is red by about 1/1000th of a degree, and that's really the motion of the Earth through the universe. We're moving at about something like 1,000 kilometers per second, and that gives us a Doppler effect where everything on that side is red and everything on that side is blue, and that's what you see in this microwave sky. You can measure our motion through the microwave sky, and we're moving in the direction of the constellation Leo, it turns out. And when you subtract that, this is what's left. This is kind of a property of the gas that produced the light as opposed to the property of the Earth. And I'll come back to that later on. So we have evidence that this is a slide. Hertzberg is a famous Canadian who won the Nobel Prize in the 50s. He was in the business of measuring the properties of molecules in space, and he could have won the prize for covering the microwave background, because in the 50s he wrote this. He had this measurement where he writes in this book, and from the intensity of these lines, it's as if everything in the space is immersed in this 2.3 degrees radiation, which of course is only very restricted meaning, which is really to say that if he just crossed that line off, he would have discovered that everything really is it's in 2 degrees of radiation, because that's the microwave background. And he just didn't realize that was supposed to be there. So later on, Henzias and Wilson got the prize because they recognized what they found. So there's evidence that nuclei formed. There's evidence that atoms formed. The Big Bang is looking pretty good. What about the dark matter, dark energy? I kind of hinted that we know the total number of atoms is there, but I haven't told you why you should believe that there's more stuff out there than the atoms. So what's that all about? So I'm going to do dark matter and dark energy in turn. The dark matter has more evidence, so there's better evidence for it to be there. And I'm not going to go through all these, I'm going to go through one again. And then I'll go to dark energy. So the way you measure dark matter is hard, because it's dark, right? That's, how are you going to find it if you can't see it? So the way you measure, you could worry that, there's the old theory of dark matter was that it's the dust bunny theory. That it's like, under your bed, there's a lot of stuff that's not very luminous. And if you measured it, it would have some mass. And you could worry that maybe the galaxies are full of planets or something, which are not very luminous, and you can't see them. Well, so what astronomers do to measure how much is out there is they say, well, let's not rely on just counting stars. Let's instead ask, how much mass is there? And how do you measure mass? Well, you can measure that directly from gravity. How do we know how massive Jupiter is? We know how massive Jupiter is because we know its orbit around the sun. And we know that orbit is due to gravity, and the force of gravity is due to the mass of the sun, not the mass of Jupiter. So I'm lying to you. I'm telling you why you know the mass of the Jupiter, the sun, not the mass of Jupiter. So we know the mass of the sun because we know that Jupiter's orbit has the properties that it has. And we know that orbit is due to the force of gravity. We measure the mass of Jupiter by looking at the moons going around Jupiter. But the main thing is, if you measure how things move and you know that gravity is responsible, then you can measure the mass that was responsible for that motion. So what you do is you do the same thing for galaxies, the clusters of galaxies. You watch galaxies rotate. We're all orbiting one another, and you can figure out the mass of the galaxy from how fast it's rotating. I'm not going to tell you about that. If you go to clusters of galaxies, galaxies tend to come inside big clusters where they're all gravitating around one another. Here's a picture of one. Everything in this picture is a galaxy. Some of them are fuzzier than others. There's a couple stars in the foreground, but for the most part, these are galaxies. And they're all in orbit around each other. And you can measure the speed using the Doppler effect or any other thing. And you can figure out how much mass had to be there to make them move that fast. And the answer is it's something like 30 times as much as you would get if you just counted the stars in the galaxies. But about 20 years ago, if you weren't in the military 20 years ago, people started to look at the sky with x-rays because they put satellites up, they could see x-rays. X-rays don't get through the atmosphere. The military had been doing that for a long time looking for bomb tests, but the general public didn't find out about it until later. And you can measure x-rays in the sky, and it turns out this cluster of galaxies is sending us x-rays, and that's emitted by a very hot gas. X-rays are emitted when the gas is at millions of degrees temperature. The sun's surface does not emit x-rays. because it's not hot enough. The sun's corona gives us x-rays, but it's much hotter. And so it's extremely hot gas is giving us this, these x-rays. And so the fact that you see these x-rays tells you there's a lot of gas in the cluster of galaxies. And there's actually more atoms in the gas than there are in the galaxies. So if you counted up all the mass of the hydrogen that's in that cloud, there's more there than in all the galaxies you're looking at if you counted up the stars. But it's still not enough to count for the mass. These things, if it's hot enough to give us x-rays, you know how fast the molecules are moving, because the temperature is motion. And it's the motion of those molecules, you can ask how much gravity would you need to keep it there and not dissipate into space. It's the same as you would need to get the galaxies to do what they're doing. And it's something like 5 to 10 times as much as you would get based on counting the gas and the galaxies. So that's the first piece of evidence that there's something there that's dark and gravitating, and it's not stars. It doesn't say that it's not planets, it just says there's something you can't see and it's gravitating. Here's another way you can do the same thing. If you look at galaxies, here's another cluster of galaxies, and you see these arcs here. Well, those arcs are formed because there's galaxies behind the ones you're looking at, and the light that comes by the galaxies in the foreground bends because gravity attracts it, and it sort of acts like a lens. And so this is a simulation. That these dots are all in the background, and they're moving past you, and there's a foreground galaxy source here, and this is showing you what the light would look like as it bends coming past the gravitational field of these things in the foreground. And you see you get all these arcs at various times. And what you're seeing is some sort of a snapshot of galaxies in the background here compared to galaxies in the foreground. Because it's gravity, you can figure out how much mass would you need to give me that arc, and you get the same answer again. You get something which is something like 10 times as much as what you actually see in the stars and the gas. So there's several different ways of measuring the mass in a cluster of galaxies, and they're all giving you more than what you see in atoms, or in visible things like stars. I told you you count the atoms, and it turns out you're getting more than you see in the atoms, too. So that's the first evidence that what you're seeing is not atoms. And that's one line of evidence. That's galaxies and clusters are one class of evidence, but there's other lines of evidence too. What about dark energy? So how do you know there's more than just dark things in galaxies or clusters of galaxies? Well, there's three lines of evidence that take you towards dark energy. So there's not nearly as much evidence heading to dark energy than dark matter. Dark matter was first discovered in the 30s, so it's been a lot of time to build up the evidence. Dark energy was discovered in 1998 or something like that, so it's something which is very recent. So there's two pieces of evidence here that I'd like to give you a flavor for. So there's two ways that people know that there's dark energy there, and that it's different from the dark matter I just talked about, is based on one of two things. One thing is measuring Hubble's law. I told you that Hubble's law was that galaxies recede from us with a speed proportional to their distance from us. And so people just said, oh, well, let's just measure that. That can't be an exactly right law. I'm saying something in the wrong order, sorry. So what these people were doing is they went out to test Hubble's law, and they want to test it at very long distances. And they did it with supernovae, because supernovae are things, what do you have to do to test Hubble's law? You have to measure something's speed and their distance separately. You can't use the Doppler effect to measure the distance of the Hubble law itself. So you have to be able to see them, and you have to know how bright they are. Because if you know how bright they are, and you look at how bright they appear to be, you can figure out how far away they are. So what they use is supernovae. This is a picture of one down here. This is not a star in the foreground. This is a galaxy which is a shitload of light years away. I can't remember exactly. But the main thing is this one is the same distance. This is one star, the same distance of those galaxies. This is 100 million or billion stars all shining together. This is one star, which is as bright as all the rest of them. And the reason it's so bright is that it's a star that's exploding. And when it explodes for about something in a couple months, it's about as bright as the whole galaxy. So you can see them a long ways away, but because you understand their explosion and you can see the explosions nearby, you also know how bright they would be if they were close to us. So by comparing how bright they appear to be to how bright they are, intrinsically, you can figure out how far away they are. And that's how you know that this is actually not in the foreground, it's actually the same distance as that galaxy. So by looking at things like supernova, you can test Hubble's law at very, very large distances, further than Hubble could test it, and this is what you expect. I showed you the straight line of speed versus distance, which said it was all speed is proportional to distance. What you're expecting is that they should be moving faster the farther back you look. Why is that? The statement that I told you that what was special about speed being proportional to distance was that they all turned off together at the same time, and the ones that are moving faster are farther away. And that was a very plausible story, but it relied on the speed not changing. But if the galaxies are accelerating, then that will change their speed. Why should they accelerate? Well, they accelerate because of gravity. And the one thing we know about gravity is that gravity is always attractive. So as the galaxies move apart from each other, they're pulling on each other and slowing each other down. So as they recede from this place where they started, they're always acting to slow each other down because galaxies, the gravity is always attractive. So the fact that they're slowing down means that if we took a snapshot now, all the galaxies are moving more slowly than they are in the past. So that means that if I look at galaxies that are farther and farther away, I'm seeing them as they were farther, longer and longer ago, because the light took a long time to get here. So the ones that are the most distant are the ones that I'm seeing as they were in the past, when they were moving faster, because in the meantime they've been slowing down. So the pattern you should expect to see is that the farther away the galaxies are that you're looking at, the faster they're moving, because they're all slowing down and you're just seeing them as they were when they were still moving fast. And so you're expecting to see something like this. Farther away means faster. So the straight line won't be true anymore. You're expecting things to go up. And the big surprise was that they did this, and this is what they found. So here's the, this is not what they actually measured. This is speed again, and this is distance. Here's the straight line they start off going on. And so more or less this black line is pretty close to the straight line. And all the points are below the line, not above the line. So that says that the universe is actually, it's true that the galaxies are not moving at a constant speed, but they're actually speeding up as they go out, rather than slowing down. And the paradox is that the way I made it sound so compelling that they had to be slowing down was that gravity was always attractive. And if gravity is always attractive, then they had to be slowing down, and so should crazy things should be speeding up. And so dark matter in particular, the reason we know it exists in galaxies and clusters of galaxies is that it is attractive, and it's that attractiveness that we use to infer its existence. So if there was dark matter out there, dark matter will not change the expectation that things should be slowing down as the universe expands. So whatever dark matter is, it can't be explained this. And so that's one piece of evidence that there's something else out there besides the dark matter that you can't see. You might ask, is there anything that can make the universe accelerate? And it turns out there is. The vacuum in particular has an energy, and it turns out that its energy is, if it has an energy, that's not such a big deal. It has a pressure, it turns out, and the pressure it has is negative, which is weird. And because it's got a negative pressure, that allows it to repel things under gravity rather than attract things under gravity. And so it is possible to have things which can accelerate the universe, but it's not ordinary things that we're used to in our everyday experience. But this is evidence that there's something out there in addition to the dark matter. And you can ask how much of the vacuum or whatever else it is you need to account for this. And what I'm about to do in the next few slides is show you three different arguments that all count how much of this stuff there is, and they all give you the same answer. It's the bottom line of those slides. So there's different color lines there. So this is the same thing again. They correspond to different amounts of dark matter and dark energy in the universe. So this is now a graph of the amount of dark matter in the same units as before, where 1 is 10 to the minus 0.9 grams per cubic centimeter. And this is the amount of dark energy, which is, I'm thinking, the vacuum having energy, and in particular having its negative pressure, and allowing it to accelerate the universe. And this 1 is the same number. So if the whole universe we see were dark matter, that would correspond to the black point. But that corresponds to the universe expanding along this black line here. And that's not a very good description of what they see. If there's even more dark matter than that, that would be the red line. That's this thing here, which is a really bad description. If you had this much dark matter and this much dark energy, that's the blue line. That's this thing, which is not a bad description. The purple one is the best of these things. That's this one. And the green one here is this one. And these ellipses here, if you statistically kind of fold in the fact that there's errors here and ask what's the evidence for the how much dark matter and dark energy there is, the preference of the data is to be up here inside that ellipse. And these different ellipses correspond to more and more error, statistical uncertainty in the conclusion. So you can basically live anywhere in this ellipse and be consistent with the observations of the universe expanding. And I'm showing you this picture because this is quantifying now how much dark energy you need. It's showing you need some because the ellipse doesn't go down to zero here. But it's showing you that how much you have depends on how much dark matter you have and other things. And so I'm going to look at this right-hand plot again a number of times using other measures of how much dark matter there is and dark energy there is to show you that there's a picture which is going to converge into a thicker amount of dark energy and dark matter. So the second line of evidence that counts for dark energy is, again, the microwave background that I talked about. This is the light from the last time this light scattered. It was interacting with the hydrogen atoms, essentially, that were forming in the universe. And there was hot areas, and there was dark areas, and cold areas. And that's physics of hydrogen, because that's telling you how hot the hydrogen gas was when it emitted the radiation. And we know a lot about hydrogen. It's the simplest atom element there is. So what you can do is you can learn about the geometry of the universe by looking at the distance between the hot and the cold areas. That'll tell you how flat the universe is. And the reason, so let me kind of explain why that tells you something about the geometry of the universe. You're looking at light, think of that, you're looking at light through the universe. It's emitted by this hot surface, and then it travels through the entire universe before it gets to you. And so you're going to infer something about the universe it went through from the fact that it's coming from you from so far away. So the way the argument works is, we know physically why the universe, why that hydrogen gas was hot in some places and cold in other places. It's sound waves. If you have a gas of hydrogen at a temperature, it's going to have sound waves, and somewhere it compresses, it's a little bit hotter than colder. And because you know the physics of hydrogen, you know how far apart those things are in meters. And so it's more or less you know the wavelength of sound, or you know how far sound can travel with the amount of the time the universe has been around. So the fact that we measure these distances, these different temperatures, is someone's held up a ruler for us at the other end of the universe because we know about hydrogen. Now what we're actually measuring, though, is the angle. We measure the direction of the hot area to the cold area is some fixed angle, so we're measuring an angle here. If we knew how far away that ruler was, how big the universe was, which we would know if we know how fast it's expanding, then we would be able to figure out from geometry the whole triangle here. We could figure out everything. So in particular, if the universe was flat and you told me how far away it was and how big the ruler was, I could tell you what the angle was. So what we'll do is we'll measure the angle, we'll measure the distance, we'll measure this distance too, and then that'll tell us whether or not we were right to get to assume it was flat. If the universe had not been flat, if it had been like a sphere, for instance, what would happen is that light would travel in straight lines. It's moving along the sphere. So two lines will kind of converge at a bigger angle if it's moving through a sphere than it would have done in a flat space. And so by changing the geometry of space for a given ruler and a given distance, we're going to get different angles that we'll measure. So by measuring these angles, measuring this distance, and measuring how far away the hot and the cold areas are in the light, you can figure out, is the universe flat enough? And the reason you care is that I told you that the total amount of energy is related to the curvature of space. And so if you measure the curvature, you're learning the total amount of stuff that's in space, regardless of what's made of it. So it turns out that the answer is such that space is flat. Space is flat as far as we can measure it in the universe. And this is showing you on that same plot now. This is the amount of dark energy and dark matter. These dots correspond to what's consistent with what the space being flat. The different colored dots correspond to different measurement values for the rate of expansion of the universe, which is the size of the universe. It's one of the things you need to know. And that's been measured in a separate experiment, and it turns out the right answer is close to 70. So the yellow dots are really what the, what the where we have to live. The fact we live in a flat space and the universe is expanding the way it is tells you from the microwave background that you have to have this much stuff. And this is dividing it up into dark energy and dark matter. So when I told you that things had to be, that there was 10 to the minus 29 gram per cubic centimeter in the universe, that's what this line is. This is where it's all dark energy, this is where it's all dark matter, and this is where it's half and half. That line is the flat line. And we know that we live on that line because the universe is immeasurably flat. So now you've been asked, is that amount of dark energy and dark matter consistent with what the universe is accelerating? It is. It's in the ellipse. Those things agree with each other. But we know how much dark matter there is because we go to galaxies. We measure how much stuff is in the galaxies. That's what you find. That's how much dark matter there would be in the galaxies. It's something like 10 times as much or 5 times as much of the number of atoms that are there. And the number of atoms that were there was only 4%. So the main message is that these pictures are giving you the same answer. So like the Big Bang story, this is giving you confidence that it's the right interpretation of what you're seeing. That you're really seeing two things, dark matter and dark energy. And several ways of measuring them that are all independent of one another are giving you the same answer. And that's what gives you confidence that it's really there, even though you have no direct experience with it. So the bottom line for physicists is that 4% of the universe is made of everything we know about. That's the chemists can have that. And so chemistry gets the atoms, and we have to figure out what the dark energy and dark matter is, and that's why it's such an incredibly exciting field to be in, because 95% of the universe is up for grabs. I should ask Damien how we're doing for time. We must be getting close.
You're doing fine.
Are we okay? Oh, yeah, the clock's right there. When you finish, I was worried you finished.
When you're
not? Okay, good. All right.
But you haven't had lunch.
Settle in. I'll be here for lunch. The reason I ask is that we're now at the point that this actually doesn't take very long if you want to hear it, but I can take you through the. So the question is, what is that stuff? The talk so far has been a bunch of arguments as to why, first of all, the Big Bang Theory works. It works in detail, and you can test it a bunch of different ways, and you have a bunch of different arguments, which, if it's the Big Bang Theory is right, should all be telling you, say, what the density of the universe is. And if the Big Bang Theory is not right, then you should be getting a whole bunch of answers from those arguments which are just different from one another, and that's just telling you that you're using the wrong model. But they're all working because it's all these things are giving me the same value for the density of the universe, and it's telling you that it's more than you see in atoms, and it's two things. There's stuff in the galaxies that gravitate like everything else, and there's stuff which makes the universe accelerate, which is different because it's making the universe accelerate. So what is it? So the dark matter story is easier to think about. Oh, here's the so this is where it gets ugly. And that's what the code's supposed to say. It's true that this is not ugly, but it's not elegant either. So people are kind of looking for what options could work. So there's three ideas in broad brush form. One of them is the dust bunny theory. It's just ordinary atoms, and you're just not seeing them. And that would, for that to work, it would have to be true that I just lied to you about the Big Bang and the coincidence. It's just a huge coincidence that you can understand the abundance of nuclei, and that was just, for some reason, just misleading you completely as the total number of atoms in the universe. And the reason I put that up there is that there's actually separate evidence that we know how much atoms there are in the universe. And the inference that the dark matter is something different doesn't rely on just that argument. Modification of the law of gravity. The whole argument for its existence was its gravitational effects. And that assumed that we knew what gravity was. So what if we were wrong? No one's tested gravity on the scale of the universe. They tested it in the solar system. So maybe you could change gravity, and maybe you would need to deal with the existence of new things. And the third thing is that it's not dust, and it's not gravity, so it's something else, and what is it something else? So what's the story for the atoms? The atoms don't seem to work. And besides the argument of nucleosynthesis that I gave you, here's another way of testing it. One way is just go through what could it be. It could be black holes, it could be planets. But if it's black holes come because they come as the end product of stars exploding. And you know how often stars explode? You can see them around you. When they explode, they tend to leave a whole bunch of residue around. You can count the residues, and you can kind of figure out from that how many black holes there should be. Black holes tend to be not completely black. Black holes are things that are so dense that their gravity is so strong that the escape velocity is faster than the speed of light, and so that means nothing escapes because nothing goes faster than the speed of light. But things, you should see them anyway, because as things fall in, they tend to radiate, so that you can find black holes, and every galaxy has a black hole in the middle of it. And our galaxy has one which is hundreds of millions of times the mass of the sun, the black hole instead of our galaxy. And you know it's there because you can see the stuff falling in. So black holes aren't for free. But a more direct measure is this. What people did is they said, well, supposing it was planets, say it was a bunch of Jupiters out there, and they're just not in near stars, they're just roaming around through space. How can you rule that out? Well, what they said is that, if there were planets out there, every once in a while one would come in front of a star in the background. And that what it did, remember, things in the foreground act as lenses for light, for the light that's going by them. And the gravitational field of the planet would take the light from the star in the background and bend it. And you wouldn't be able to see it carefully enough to tell that it was being bent. You wouldn't see an arc or anything. But you'd see that there was a multiple image. And so there'd be, for a brief period of time, the star would be twice as bright because you'd see it twice. So what people did is they said, well, if there's planets out there, we should see stars every once in a while getting brighter. But it's a 1 in a million shot because what's the odds of a planet being in front of a star? So what they said is that, well, great, we'll automate the whole process. We'll photograph the next galaxy over every night, and we'll just shoot millions of stars every night for a year, and then sooner or later we're going to have to see one of these things. And they did. They've seen something like 10, this has happened 10 or 15 times, and now there's more than one experiment. They do the next galaxy over, they do the middle of our galaxy. But they can see how many times it happens, and it does happen. If you watch the light of a star, it just does nothing for a while, and it spikes, and it does, this is actually, there's a particular case where it looks like there's two planets going by, so it might have been a binary star, binary system, so it happens twice. But you see a spike like this whenever something goes in the foreground because of this fact that it's bending light. And it definitely happens, but given that you've seen it happen, you can count how many of the planets there would have to be to account for it happening, and it's not enough to be the dark matter, so it's a short version of the story. So there's various ways you can look for ordinary atoms because you know what ordinary atoms do. And all the ways you can check don't allow you to account for the dark matter because you know how much dark matter there has to be. It's got to be enough to account for the way our galaxy behaves. What about gravity? This is the one that people think about a lot because there's a lot of glory in this one. If you were the one who finds the new law of gravity because of this, then 100 years from now they'll be celebrating you and hell with Einstein. So there's a lot of thought to put into this, but it's harder than it looks, it turns out. And there's no, I think the bottom line is, although people have thought about it a lot, there's no credible proposals. And because we actually understand a lot about the laws of physics that we didn't understand in Einstein, a lot. And one of them is that we understand now on very general grounds. Quantum mechanics and special relativity together basically imply that if you get anything roughly like gravity to work, it will be general relativity in detail. And so that it's very difficult to change the laws of gravity without also changing some fundamental thing in quantum mechanics or in special relativity. That's a beautiful thing because it tells us why Einstein had to be right. Same thing is true for Maxwell's equations. If you get anything that has a Coulomb law in it, it will look like Maxwell's equations because of quantum mechanics and special relativity, and you don't have any options in what it's going to look like. And so it's a very deep statement about why the laws of nature are what they are. But it in particular says that it's very difficult to be, you can't fuck with Mother Nature and try and get dark matter. Your hands are tied. And so although people have tried very hard, it's been unsuccessful. New kinds of particles is the easy one. This is why I told you that every other graduate student in the world has got a theory of dark matter. It's because of this. I told you about relics. Nuclei form, atoms form. If you had heavy kinds of particles around, everybody in the world that's a particle physicist believes there are heavy particles around. And they're building an accelerator in CERN to find them. There's lots of heavy particles that we know that exist, much heavier than the proton. And there's almost certainly other ones that haven't been discovered yet because the accelerator's not big enough yet, but they're being built now to be seen. Any kind of particle like that, if it's stable, all the particles we know about that are heavy like that decay very quickly, so you wouldn't see them in the universe. But if you could find one that was stable, you would know how many of them would be around now, because the physics of the universe was that they were once hot and they were in equilibrium with everything else. Their abundance was set by the abundance of hydrogen and everything else that we see. At some point, they stopped interacting very much with the other stuff, and so they just sat around the rest of the universe. But their abundance is fixed by physics. And all it depends on is how heavy they are and how strongly they interact with everything else. And if you have a generic kind of thing that everybody expects to be there anyway, you will get the right abundance. That's why the new kind of particle theory is really easy to make work. All you need to do is make up a new particle which has the kind of mass that would be just not as been seen yet in accelerators, and have the kind of interactions that would be just like the ones that have not been seen yet in accelerators, and that will be around in abundance. The hard part is to make it stable, but once it's stable, it's for free, dark. So it's not so difficult to make things stable. You give them a conserved charge so that there's nothing they can't decay, and then there you go, you're out. So this is, if you had to bet money, this is what you'd bet on. There's no evidence that this is right yet, but it's the thing which is the most plausible given what we know about physics. And so people have built detectors to find this stuff. You know how much there has to be. And so in particular, in Sudbury, they're about to put in a new detector, and there are detectors now around the world which look for these particles. If they are there, they're like neutrinos. They go right through the Earth. They would go right through us. And they would, right now, through every square centimeter, the sun is sending 10 billion neutrinos every second. And you don't know that they're there because they interact very weakly. But these things would interact with the same amount. They're much heavier than neutrinos, so if they hit you, you'd know it. But they, the odd atom would know it. You might not know it. But it'd be like a cosmic ray. So you can detect them. So that the people are looking for them, and if this is right, you will know, because you'll find them both in accelerators and in these detectors for dark matter. But if you had to bet money, that's what I'd say is going on. Now, the dark energy is hard. Why is it hard? I told you that the dark energy, you could have something which would make the universe accelerate. You need something with an abundance which is almost all of what's out there, 10 to the minus 29 grams per cubic centimeter. In particle physics units, that's 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth power, it turns out. Electron volt being the amount of energy an electron gets when it falls through a volt. And people in particle physics use energy as a unit for everything, because if you, H bar and C allow you to make that into anything, you can make a length or a mass or time or anything out of energy using H bars and C's. So that's what you need. But you also need something which accelerates the universe. So this is the one equation in the second equation in the whole talk. If you ask Einstein what makes the universe accelerate, this is his answer. He says A is the size of the universe. And dot means the rate of change with respect to time. And so two dots means the acceleration of the rate of change, the acceleration of the expansion. So this says that the left-hand side is the acceleration of the expansion of the universe, which we've measured to be positive. The right-hand side is what's gravitating. So this is Newton's constant, and there's some H bars and C's running around here, I've written down. There's a minus sign, which is P. Now, this is the energy density in the universe, forget this for now. And that's positive. And so when I told you that gravity attracts, and that means the universe has to decelerate, that's what Einstein would have said if this term hadn't been there. If that's positive, and this sign makes this negative, that says the acceleration is negative. That's what Einstein's statement would have been. But Einstein says that pressure also gravitates. Why? It sounds surprising, but it shouldn't be, because pressure is heat. It's the energy associated with random motion of things. And all energy gravitates for Einstein. So that means that not only does mass gravitate, but pressure gravitates too. And it turns out it gravitates three times as much. Ordinary sources that we look at, like rocks, don't have much pressure compared to the mass, mc squared mass. And so this thing always wins for ordinary things. But if you have a lot of pressure, this can win. And in particular, it turns out that the vacuum has pressure. And the vacuum pressure is negative. And it's equal to and opposite to its energy density. So the vacuum satisfies the pressure is minus the energy density. So this whole thing is negative. And that's why the vacuum can make things accelerate. So if you plotted the energy, this is now energy in the universe against the age of the universe, or the size of the universe. What happens, I told you things cool. This shows you that the blue line is what the radiation does, the microwave background, for instance. It's cooling off. It turns out it's cooling off proportional to 1 over the size of the universe to the fourth power. The red line is matter, so this is like protons and neutrons. It cools off like 1 over, the energy goes down like 1 over the volume. It just says this, the total energy is the mass, total mass is there. So the density is the mass divided by the volume. As the volume gets bigger, the energy goes down. The radiation goes down faster because not only does the volume get bigger, but each individual photon redshifts on top of that. So that's why it goes down faster. But because the pressure is negative for the vacuum just sits there. And so its energy is constant. And the only way that it can be consistent with conservation of energy is that the pressure has to be negative. And that's kind of how you know the vacuum has negative pressure. So the fact that the energy of the vacuum doesn't change is the same thing as saying its pressure is negative and that it gravitates in a funny way. And it can make the universe accelerate in the picture. So what's the problem? That sounds like I've given you a simple solution to what the dark energy is. The problem is you can calculate the energy of the vacuum. Quantum mechanics, it's a zero-point motion. If you've thought of quantum mechanics, harmonic oscillators never sit at the bottom. The uncertainty principle makes them have a very small residual amount of energy. And the same thing is true for everything, including all the elementary particles. You can calculate the energy, and the short version is the energy that the electron contributes to the vacuum is 500,000 electron volts to the fourth power. And the measured value is 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth power. So that everything gives you an enormous vacuum energy compared to what you measure. So the problem is not how do you get a vacuum energy, it's how do you get such a small vacuum energy. Particle physics and quantum mechanics tells you the universe should never have been as big as it is. The gravity of the vacuum should have closed it off really quickly. And there's a big puzzle that no one really understands as to why the vacuum energy that we infer knowing the particles that are there is so different from the way the vacuum appears to gravitate. I have a theory for that, but it's, you know, but there's 10,000 other people who have other theories too. I stole this from Rocky Polk's talk. I don't know if some of you might have seen the public lecture he gave here. He had a slide of cosmology of the past 1,000 years ago, and then he had a subscript ending present day Kansas. And he picked one of this. So, what's the bottom line? I was just going to summarize. Here we go. So the things I'm going to leave you with are these. The first one is, I started with a paradox. I told you cosmology seems to work really well. And that's the first message. It works really well. And it works really well in the same sense that the theory of atoms work really well. There's many lines of evidence that all, if the Big Bang picture is right, then it predicts several things. It predicts that you should understand the abundance of nuclei in the early universe because you know the universe cooled down through a point where nuclei formed. And it tells you detailed predictions as to how much stuff there is, and it works. We see that much stuff. It also tells us that atoms would have formed at some point, and the universe, which was originally opaque, would have become transparent. There should be a lot of light running around now. It looks like it just last saw, billions of years ago, a bunch of hot hydrogen. That light is there, and I didn't tell you about it, but it has all the properties you expected to have if it was in a thermal equilibrium with hydrogen in the past. Everything works the way it's supposed to work. If you look at that light, if that light interacts with something between when it last scattered and us, it's cooled down in the meantime because the universe is expanding. But you can measure that because if there's hydrogen in the foreground, it can absorb some of the light and re-emit it. And the temperature that you see scales with distance the way it is, exactly the way it's supposed to. There's many, many ways of testing the Big Bang Theory, and they all work like a charm. So there's very little doubt at all that the Big Bang Theory is right because it's so redundantly tested, in much the same way that we had little doubt of atoms even before they had been seen. But the kicker is that you have to buy, and there's two kinds of things out there that you can't see. It's not just a big stretch to think that there's things out there you can't see. Most things around us are dark. Everything in the room in space would not be seen from light years away if we were all out there, because we're not very bright.
So,
in the infrared. But the thing is that we have an independent handle on how many atoms there were to make things from. So in addition to counting what you see, the gas in a cluster of galaxies, the galaxies in the cluster of galaxies, how fast the galaxies are rotating, and other ways of counting, you know, how soon the galaxies form, there's many, many ways of getting a hold of how much stuff is gravitating. It points you always to the same number, something like 10 times as much as the atoms that you see. And that's more than the number of atoms that could be there from arguments like where the nuclei came from in the early universe. So you have to believe there's something that's dark, and it's not made of atoms. But you have to believe there's two things that are dark, because whatever the dark matter is, it cannot make the universe accelerate. I mean, the universe is now being, its acceleration as a function of time, its expansion as a function of time is being measured, and it is accelerating. Things in the past are moving more slowly than they are now, the galaxies that are far, far away from us. And they should have been moving more quickly if they had been really, the universe had been gravitating the way ordinary things would gravitate. So the surprise was that we've got the first time in the human thought a way of measuring the total amount of energy in the universe now, and in the last 10 billion years, 15 billion years. And the good news is all the stuff we think is there is there. But the bad news is, or the good news, depending on who you are, that there's a lot of stuff, and most of the stuff that's there, we don't understand at all. It's 95% of it is unknown stuff. 20% of the universe is dark matter, and that's very plausibly stuff that we have not discovered yet, but we could discover soon. But 75% of what's out there, the dark energy, is completely unknown. It's probably vacuum energy of some sort, but there's a very fundamental theoretical problem in understanding why it's the size it is. So thank you for your time.
Well.